Hello and welcome, Word Nerds, to DIY MFA Radio, the show that will help you write more, write better, write smarter. I'm Gabriella Pereira, instigator of DIY MFA and your host for this podcast. Now let's talk writing. Hello, hello, Word Nerds. Gabriella here, and welcome back to DIY MFA Radio. Before we dive into today's episode, let me just remind you that our show notes will be over at diymfa.com/135, because it's episode 135. And today's episode features someone who I'm really excited to talk to. His name is Brian Meal, and he is the author of four novels, some of whom, which have garnered some really amazing awards and starred reviews. His books, Out of Patience, Suck It Up and Die, I love that title, and You Don't Know About Me, are just awesome. They've gotten tons of awards and great reviews, but his most recent book, Blowback 07, transports readers back in time to 1907, and it's about a time when legendary coach Pop Warner and future Olympian Jim Thorpe and the Carlisle Indian Industrial School's team, the Redmen, basically turned America's most popular sport, i.e. football, upside down and basically turned it into the game that it is today. Kind of perfect to be having this conversation right around Super Bowl time. And in a former incarnation, this was the part that really got me excited to talk to Brian. He was a puppeteer on Sesame Street. And also in Jim Henson's films, including The Dark Crystal, which is one of my favorites. And he also wrote for television shows like The Magic School Bus and Between the Lions, which he won 3 Emmys for. He currently lives in Connecticut, and he's working on the sequels to Blowback 07, titled Blowback 63 and Blowback 94. Welcome, Brian. It is so great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
So can I just say, I am having such a fangirl moment right now to be talking to someone who was a puppeteer on Sesame Street and Jim Henson movies. I am such a Muppet fan. It is not, I can't even start. Like, oh my gosh, I'm dying
well,
here.
Well, Gabriella, if I were to do one of my old characters, Telly Monster, I'm more scared than you are.
Aww.
So you just hang in there, and we'll get through this together.
I love it. And I have to say, Dark Crystal, it's like one of those movies that, unless people are real diehard fans, they don't really know about it. And people who see it and don't know that it's Jim Henson are often like kind of blown away that it's Jim Henson. And I'm like, well, duh, of course it is. And it's just, it's such a great movie. So I just love that you worked on that. And we're definitely going to talk about that later in the interview.
All right.
But first, let's start by talking about your most recent book, which is fascinating in its own right. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired the story? Particularly, like, tell us a little about the back in time football angle, which I think is really interesting.
Well, to really take it back, I had written a screenplay that got optioned several times and never got made, but I turned it into a novella and published it. And it was about sending a very full of himself superstar Major League Baseball player back to 1944. During the World War II and having to play in a very, very different era of baseball. And he kind of goes back and is forced to play with his hapless team in St. Louis. And he gets kind of, shifted, and his inner compass shifted, and re-falls in love with the game and understands why he plays baseball. So the seminal idea of sending a contemporary athlete back to another era to not only introduce the reader to a narrative about an interesting character, but also to do some fun historical fiction, basically sports historical fiction, about a particular sport in a different era. So I had that idea, and I wrote that some time ago. So it was always clunking around in the back of my head. And I happened to read a wonderful nonfiction book by a sports reporter for the Washington Post named Sally Jenkins, and she wrote a book called The Real All-Americans, which was all about the Carlisle Indian School and the huge effect they had on making the modern game of football, and very transformative, game-changing season that I fell in love with was the 1907 season. So I became, you know, kind of that idea of sending an athlete back again, kind of woke back up. It had been dormant for like 15, 20 years. And I decided I wanted to send a high school kid back. And, you know, a hotshot quarterback that goes back and he tries to be a hotshot quarterback for the Carlisle Indians when he gets sent back. But the ball's different. It's much bigger. He doesn't know the rules. He totally crashes and burns. And he gets demoted to the line, and he basically has to relearn the game from the ground up and become buddies with a young Jim Thorpe when Thorpe was only 19 and a scrub halfback on that team. And all of this is based on what was really going on. And the story idea kind of kept expanding, and instead of just being that book, the facilitators of this time travel are a couple of warring twins, Archie and Iris, who have nothing in common, and they have a much a wider narrative arc to resolve. In that, at the very beginning of this first book, Blowback 07, their mother's been missing for a year, and she's a an astrophysicist who's been on hiatus from her university and has been learning to play this very bizarre old instrument known, we call it the English horn, but back then it was called the cor anglais, and it's a family heirloom that has a legend attached to it. So that this instrument, this woodwind instrument, becomes the device for the time travel that these two twins end up discovering. Iris, the girl, is a music geek and plays the oboe and has inherited this cor anglais and trying to figure out what it has to do with her missing mother, etc. So without going over the whole thing, I basically have four kind of multi-protagonists, four of them, and they're what I call my time travel team. And in the three books, the three blowback books, all four of those characters will eventually, it's only Matt, who's the football player in the first book, who goes back to 1907. But very quickly, these other characters, the two twins and another kid who's a baseball player, get sent back to these different eras. And they work out this entire kind of three-book arc about the quest the twins have for the mother and the conflict the twins have. So that's kind of the overview of it. And the inspiration was basically learning about this school and these Native American players. Of course, the Carlisle Indian School was all Native Americans. And they really revolutionized the game of football, and in 1907 invented the passing game. So it's a wonderful historical chapter that is very little known about it. We just don't. I mean, when you say to people, well, the forward pass was illegal for the first 40, 50 years of football. It wasn't made legal until 1906. So there's all sorts of neat football stuff in there as well.
I love it. And it's also interesting because there's a lot of tension, I think, around sort of the role of the Carlisle School, right? Like, I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on around that maybe wasn't as positive. Can you talk about kind of the cultural context as well?
Yeah. I've actually been down to Carlisle about four times. And I was down there in October at a conference run by the Cumberland County Historical Society, and it was all about Native American contribution to sport. And particularly in the last 5 years, academians and historians have been much tougher on the Carlyle School. I mean, I was hearing, you know, phrases like cultural appropriation, and they were basically forced. It was a military school, military academy, and the man who founded it, this guy named Pratt, had an expression, and I may be paraphrasing, but his motto was kill the savage, save the man. Now, this school started back in the late 1870s, while there were still some Indian wars going on. Wounded Knee was in 1890. The school was 11 years old at that point. So there was kind of a there's a dark side and a bright side to Carlyle. The bright side is the incredible athletes and a certain number of professionals that went on to college and became doctors and lawyers and dentists and basically acclimated into society once that they were shown, quote unquote, the white road, as they referred to it. So there was a lot of success stories out of the Carlyle Indian School. And that's what's been kind of the light's been shined on that via athletics and their football. And of course, Jim Thorpe was famous Olympian that came out of there with Pop Warner as his track and football coach. And Thorpe in 1912 won the two Olympics that then went on to become such a controversy. But the dark side of the Carlyle School is if, you know, you weren't an athlete, and eating better food and in a your separate dormitory and all this, it was very rough, and a huge percentage of those students, you know, and I forget the number, maybe somewhere between 5 and 10% actually died there. From they either came with diseases or they caught diseases. It was a school that stripped them of their culture in an attempt. The intention was, a good one, you know, try to get them off the reservation and not only educate them in Western kind of white ways, but also give them a trade. And the unfortunate thing about the school was they gave all these kids and young women and men a trade, but then sent them back to the reservation where there was no work. So the success stories out of Carlyle were the ones that really kind of didn't go back to the reservation and acclimated and went into society. I mean, one of the other wonderful success stories was there's an entire coaching tree of all these players that came out of football and track and lacrosse that learned Pop Warner and learned football, and they were a very famous team. And many of these players went on to become great coaches at colleges and even in the NFL when the NFL finally started going in the 20s. So, you know, there was a great contribution out of those athletic programs, and because these players were so versed in a famous formation called the single wing that Pop invented in 1907, you know, they had a knowledge of football that made them great coaches and went on to huge successes.
That's amazing, and it must have taken a lot of really in-depth research to kind of dig up and make that come to life. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the research that went into crafting the 1907 components of the story?
I'm a research freak. I missed my calling. I should have been a dramaturg for playwrights so I could just do nothing but research. The research is fascinating because I've always been a huge reader and researcher into Native American stuff. I even, when I was back in my 20s, I even lived in a teepee in the woods of Maine for about 10 months. So I've always been a Native American-ophile. So there was a ton of reading about that. There's a ton of reading about the era. about football and the history of football. And one of the things that I love to do, you know, which is to a certain degree, you got to do it, is getting the language in this and the jargon and the slang. So my research, I have tons of files, and just, you know, one of the files that I'd love to dip back into now and again as I'm writing is my language files, which is just filled with all these weird slang words and things like that. And to give you an example of when you get down into that research and you get to a neat thing, a nugget, you know, why do we use the term touchdown? Where did that come from? And back in that era, and before that era, if I'm a runner and I cross the goal line, there was no end zone, there was just a goal line, and the goalpost was right there on that line, you could run into it. If I cross the goal line, it's not a touchdown until I touch the ball to the ground. That had to be done. So that's where we get TD. Touchdown was initially literally that. So you in all the research that you get to do when you're doing a history piece like this, you just find all this stuff, and of course your first draft is crammed with way too much of it, and you have to you know, pare it out and kill your babies, as we say. But that's part of the challenge. There's a historical fiction writer, I've forgotten her name, she's quite famous. And she writes historical fiction novels about the royalty of England, the kings and queens through the years and centuries. And she, in an interview, she made a wonderful quote. She said, because she's an avid researcher and digs, and she said it so succinctly. She said, "Where the facts end, fiction begins." And I've always loved that.
I love it, too. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And one of the fun things that I get to do is I end up on my website, which is blowbacktrilogy.com. I put a bunch of research and stuff that I don't include in the book. And one of the things that I do enjoy doing is I always have a little appendix at the back of the book with some separation of what's fact, what's fiction. And, you know, some directions that people could go if they wanted to read more about that particular era.
You know, and I love that you say that, because I think a lot of writers often struggle, especially if they're, you know, writing their first book, they're often struggling with juggling both the writing of the thing itself and then also the infamous P word, platform. And like, how do you build your presence online? What do I do on my website? What do I put on there? You mean I have to write even more stuff? And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that there's a ton of stuff that ends up on the cutting room floor, as it were, for your novel that could end up being perfect fodder for additional blog posts or a web page or what have you. So I think that's such a great example.
Yeah, and you really got to think you have to think about this, the specific idiosyncrasies of your project and your book, and then start thinking out of the box. Like I'm kind of at a crossroads with my website on this, and that I've done like a 14 blog string on basically about football and the history of football in that season of 1907, and that's on my website, and I did it during the fall, paralleling the Carlisle season of 1907. And I was able to squeeze in a whole bunch of neat stuff. But there's, okay, how do you keep up your social media? What's next? And right now I'm in a transition because I'm trying to finish the second book. But one of the things that I might do next is there's all these wonderful visuals I've collected of pictures of the school. And some of the school still exists. It's part of the U.S. Army War College now because the Army took it back a long time ago. But there's postcards and all these old pictures of what the place looked like and some of the characters. So I'm playing now. I haven't started doing it, but I'm playing now with the idea of Matt, who's back there in 1907, writing little short postcards, even though he knows they'll never get to the future or the present where Archie and Iris are, but like writing little short postcards from his voice and me, the writer, just using his voice and putting that on as a kind of a blog string is his postcards, you know? So I think, you know, and you see a lot of writers with social media, there are a lot of them that are just fantastic that keep, you know, kind of reinventing their material and expanding their platform by doing the social media. I'm a complete neophyte and rather resistant. I'm kicking and dragging into it.
You know, it's interesting though, because I think one of the things that a lot of writers, especially if they're just getting started with this, that they don't realize they're already major experts in one mm-hmm. very important thing, and that's themselves. So a lot of times, like, taking that nugget of something that you just obsess about anyway, like the fact that I'm kind of obsessed with the Muppets and I'm kind of obsessed mm-hmm. with like Disney World and theme parks, and like that stuff just seeps into your online presence, and sometimes it ends up informing what you create around your book, not necessarily in your book, in ways that are unexpected and kind of fun. So mm-hmm. I think that idea that you said of, you know, these postcards coming from the past in Matt's voice, and I could imagine, for instance, you know, extension of that once book 2 comes out and book 3, and whoever it is who gets transplanted into the past yep. in those books might have their own version of that happening. So, like, for writers to really mm-hmm. think creatively about material they've already created or that they're already into, like, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's kind of just what you're already doing. You can repackage that for online.
Right. Right. And I think one of the tough things for writers, because they are being writers and working by themselves so much, we tend to be very self-involved. And one of the bridges that need to be gapped is you really need to put yourself, just like you'd put yourself into the shoes of a character, you need to put yourself into the shoes of your readers and really think about what would they be interested in? What would make them, you know, what visuals, what memes, what would interest them? I'm older than most YA writers. So that's sometimes a stretch for me. So I have two daughters. I pick their brains and I certainly have some young reader friends and all that. So, but that's the other challenge. You need to think about what would they want to see? What would they want to hear about?
I completely agree with you. And I think that's another piece that I think was really interesting, sort of shifting back to look at another aspect of the book, like how you kind of made something that for a lot of teenagers is completely inaccessible and like, OMG, whatever, into something really like central to the book. And I'm talking here about, of course, the cor anglais, which is an instrument that most people probably don't even know exists. I happen to love both the English horn and the oboe because I grew up around music. I played the violin for a bazillion years. And
oh,
so
okay.
I played in orchestras. The oboists were always like the instrument that the violinists love because like they're always in tune. Like when you're concertmaster, you point to the oboe. They're the ones who gives the A. So like
yeah,
I
right,
had a very
right.
special relationship with the oboists in the orchestras I played in. And you know, and of course the oboe is also like the hardest instrument to play like in the entire orchestra. So you got to give oboists a lot of respect. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't realize, you know, what this instrument is all about. And so unless you're in that world, it's, you know, it's one of those things that I think could be either a teenage reader might neglect it or not even realize that it's a thing. And I love how you kind of brought it to life in the book. So can you talk about that? Like, why the cor anglais and why, how did you make it so accessible to the story?
Well, the story was kind of coming together. I was looking for this device and I had in mind that it would be a musical instrument. And of course you have the tradition of the magic flute, which is a different kind of story. But, and I ran across in my, I was particularly, I've always, in some of my books, you know, wood is an important thing. Wood is in my vampire kind of comedy thing. The bristlecone pines of California and Nevada are very important to the kind of cosmology of the story and the vampire origin kind of myth that I have in my book. So, but wood's always been important to me. So I wanted to go to a woodwind, and I also wanted the sense of that air and blowing and all that. And I started researching woodwinds, and I immediately settled on the cor anglais because there's the translation of what cor anglais means originally. The instrument was first invented in the 1720s in what's now either Poland or Germany. It was I think it's now Poland, but it was originally Germany then, kind of southeast Germany. And the cor anglais in the dialect from that part of Germany and the Slavic area also meant not English horn as we've translated it, but the horn of angels. And I became very intrigued by that because you in tapestries and stuff you'll see these long instruments that angels are playing. So I became very I kind of fell in love with the idea of the cor anglais being the horn of angels, and it actually having these other powers of acting in an angelic way and coming down and helping someone. So I eventually, I don't want to give it away, but eventually in the third book, I finally get this jongleur cor anglais, the last name of the family, the twins, the mother's name is jongleur. But in the jongleur family, this instrument's been coming down for 400 years. It's one of the original ones, and it's curved, and it has a bas-relief spider carved on the end of it, the bell of it. And this instrument has the legend that's attached to it, and I'm going to eventually, in the third book, get to an interesting reveal about an angelic connection to this horn. So...
That's awesome.
That's all part of the big spider web, I guess.
And, you know, spider web, of course, is so apt given the spider, and we're not going to give away how exactly the cor anglais works, but mm-hmm. there's definitely a webby notion to it. So mm-hmm. that's fantastic. I love it. So, mm-hmm. and I also love just kind of how all these disparate pieces of sort of awesome, juicy details all come together to form this book. So I cannot wait to see how it continues to play out.
That dovetailing is crucial. And one of the questions I sometimes get was, you know, what was the toughest part about writing the book? And even in the second book now, one of the toughest parts that is a wonderful challenge, but sometimes it has you tearing your hair out, is the book jumps in back and forth. And you have to dovetail, or the writer does, have to dovetail what's going on in the present with what's going on in the past. And it's part of the fun, but keeping those two narratives alive is great fun. And, of course, the master of this was, I grew up originally as an actor, and the master of this was Shakespeare. You had these two kind of major plots going along, and by God, by the end of the story, they all come together.
Yeah. Exactly. Especially in the comedies, I think you see that a lot where you kind of have the two parallel, or mm-hmm. like even Midsummer Night's Dream with like the three different couples and the parallels between all of them, and then it all sort of ties yep. in the last act. I love it.
Yeah.
And you know, what you're saying also about kind of bringing all the pieces together and sustaining the different stories ties exactly with where I wanted to go next, which okay. is the idea of jumping between the different characters. So one of the things that caught my attention right away as a writing geek is the use of point of view, mm-hmm. because it's very clearly an omniscient point of view, but it's not that omniscient that we're used to, where it's very, you know, arm's length, the sort of bird's eye view, we're seeing the story from afar. No, we're in it. We're right there with the characters. And when we're in a character's head, we're in that character's head. Like, we feel and think exactly what that character is feeling and thinking, which totally works in a YA world. I don't think you could do a YA novel where it is that distant point of view. And so, obviously, that poses its own challenges, because if you don't balance it out, or if you're not careful about jumping from one character's consciousness to another, it could get confusing very quickly. But I never felt sort of out of sync. I always knew where we were and whose thoughts we were attached to in a given moment, even if we shifted between characters within the same scene. So how do you pull that off as a writer? How do you keep the reader grounded in who they're supposed to be following in a given scene without them feeling disoriented or all over the place?
Well, a little bit of it is ignorance is bliss on my part, in that, you know, I don't know where this kind of, I think the fact that I'm following so many characters, and this is the first, I've done a two book series with a pretty main protagonist. But I've never done a three-book series with this many protagonists. So to me, it was a natural progression, particularly since I'm jumping from the present to the past, from the past to the present. I'm jumping back and forth. My feeling is if a reader can handle jumping from period to period and place to place, they can handle a little point of view hopscotching too. And I, you know, this is part of my Sesame Street training was, you know, let them taste good things. In other words, challenge the reader. Don't dumb it down. And from a, you know, I read a fair amount of YA, but, and I try to read adult stuff, but I mainly read reviews of adult stuff because I just don't have time. But if you have books out there where you're shifting characters' point of view from chapter to chapter, why can't you, within a chapter, have characters, the audience, the reader knows them, and I'm also making an appeal to different kinds of readers. Pick your protagonist. You know, pick if you feel like Iris is the character you want to kind of follow, then yeah, I want to appeal to that reader. So I did in one of the reviews I got, there was a critical line about, you know, the shifting point of view, and I got kind of slammed for it, and by that particular reviewer, and I kind of went, well, you know, what's the old you can't handle multiple truths or multiple points of view. To me, it's like it's a challenge for the reader, and if it's sometimes a little disorienting, well, time travel is a little disorienting too, so it's part of the fun.
I love that.
I don't know if that answers the question, Gabriella, but I my first answer, ignorance is bliss, was I just kind of did it naturally. It wasn't intentional, just because I want the readers to have an insight into all of these characters.
So I love that because it definitely confirms one of the things that I believe, which is that writers need to trust their instincts. Like, if it's very easy to let ourselves get derailed by second guessing or thinking too much about the rules, as it were. And granted, it's good to know what the conventions are so we can, you know, break them artfully. But I think it's also important to understand that, like, sometimes when you do something reflexively, it's because you've already internalized a lot of what works by reading a lot and being in that universe of that literature, that genre. And so I think that that's just great for writers to hear, that, like, we should trust our own instincts. At the end of the day, we're the ones driving the bus and writing the book, as it were.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's funny, you've kind of triggered something in my head that I hadn't really ever thought about, but I come from the theater, and, you know, I did a little bit of writing, and you have to step into every character and write them. And people who look at the theater and go to the theater, they're used to sitting there watching many characters with many different points of view, banging around. And I think that, you know, I'll go out on a limb and say, I think readers and contemporary audiences, particularly young audiences, are smart enough to follow the internal thread of several characters. You know, there's some romance in this book, and there's even more in the second book. And in the first book, even though the romance between Matt and the Native American girl he meets, Tawny Owl, it's all from his point of view. But I'll give you a little teaser. In the second book, Matt and Iris, back in the present, begin to flirt with a romantic relationship. And because I have so much invested in both of those characters, I have scenes where you get point of view, internal point of view from both of them. And I think readers are up to it.
Absolutely. And I think also, like, one of the things that I thought really worked is that it still felt very grounded. Like, even though we shifted point mm-hmm. of view, from my perspective as a reader, I didn't feel like you can tell the difference between when you're the writer's playing like head hop ping pong with the reader's head mm-hmm. versus, you know, like you're in this character, you're with them, then you shift here and it's just a very quick shift. Like it felt different. Mm-hmm. So it's good for writers to see that there are different ways of doing things. Just because the convention mm-hmm. says this is how point of view works doesn't mean that that's the way we have to always do it. This is how people break the rules and how they create new rules. And I'm doing air quotes here.
Right.
So speaking, like you touched on this already with talking about your role in theater and working in television, but I wanted to go back to kind of the past life or past lives you've had as someone who's also had...
Of my checkered past.
I've also had many past lives, as it were, though for me it was in toy design mm-hmm. and child psychology, so slightly different mm-hmm. world. But I think that there's definitely a thread between everything you've done. Like you've talked about working in theater, working as a puppeteer in Sesame Street, writing for television. All of these things have to do with storytelling and bringing stories mm-hmm. to life for an audience. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned from those different lives and then how you've brought that learning into your current work?
Yeah, I mean, it is very much a progression. I have two websites, and I on my first website, it's just brianmeal.com. You know, I talk about the first character that I incarnated as a little kid, and I was a Zorro freak. I was Zorro.
I loved Zorro, by the way. As a kid, I loved Zorro.
I had a cape and a mask and a sword with a piece of chalk on the end, and I drove my mother crazy by putting Z's all over the furniture and the walls and stuff like that with my little chalk sword.
I love it.
But so anyway, actually on my website, I have a picture of me charging the camera when I was 5 in Zorro. And about, I don't know, 30 years later, I did dress up as Zorro with my daughters to a Halloween costume. So he's always been my hero. But the point is, you know, I was always stepping into roles. You know, kids do that. You play a role. That's the fun of play, and extended for me into theater. And I guess I could summarize the pivotal moment for me was when I had left Sesame Street and I was trying to get back to my writing and acting. And I was in L.A. and, you know, doing a little episodic work here and there. And I had this revelation. I was also working on something. I was working on writing a screenplay, and I had this kind of epiphany of, gee, I go out and I audition and I audition and I audition, and occasionally I get a part, you know, and there's some actors who call themselves auditioners, not actors, because you do a lot of auditioning. So you're constantly auditioning for the right to do the process. And I'm sitting there, and I'm kind of writing and writing, and then I send out a piece of writing, and I get rejected. And then the light bulb went off. Wait a minute. As a writer, you get to do the process first, then get rejected. that's much better. So I kind of, my heels began to cool about performing at that point. And the other lovely benefit of, you know, I spent 20 plus years being a performer. But the great thing about being a writer is you don't just play one or two roles, you play them all. So.
You know, it's funny because I think, like, as someone who started as a writer and has always been a writer at heart, and who is now just starting to make her way onto the stage with speaking, I find mm-hmm. the prospect of, like, to me, it's so much easier to get rejected and then, oh, well, then I don't have to do all that work, as opposed to, oh my gosh, I did all this work. And then I got rejected. So it's funny, like, it sort of cuts both ways. Like, for, it's almost like the grass is greener, no matter where you are. But I love it. That's such a great way of thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, and also, if you've spent a number of years as an actor and are used to a certain amount of rejection, it makes you appropriately thick-skinned when it comes to writing. But I think that, you know, all writers have to keep in mind that, you know, whether they publish something or not, it's part of their own growth and process. And you know, you're not going to publish everything you write. And that's just the law of averages. And somebody was telling me recently that there are a million books published a year now in the U.S.
Yeah.
which is just amazing. But the market's splintered, and there's still ways to, you know, get your stuff out there and be published. But sometimes, like the book I talked about, the novella, as an experiment, I mean, my first four books were with Random House. And the novella, I just did an experiment, because it's only about 130 pages. I just self-published it as an experiment. But the fact that that book, you know, it's never going to sell a number of copies and stuff, but that was a seminal book for what I'm doing now. So it's always part
of the process, right? Like, it's always, no matter, there's no wasted work in writing, I guess, is what I'm trying to
say everything you write is a sketch or a blueprint to something that's going to be realized. So, you know, that's the positive way to spin it.
That's fantastic. And that, of course, transitions us perfectly into our last question. I always end each interview by asking, what is your number one tip for writers?
My number one tip, oh boy. Well, I mean, obviously there's, you're going to make me just pick one.
I know, it's so hard.
Okay, the one just popped into my head because I've had to do it myself recently. When you get stuck and you feel like this isn't coming together, I'm stuck. The best thing to do is go backwards several steps. One step, two steps, go back. And usually that's where you find the problem. I learned this when I was writing a lot of half-hour PBS style television that was curriculum-driven but was entertaining, you know, Magic School Bus, Eureka's Castle, all that kind of stuff. And when you came to a problem that you were up against and it just the solution wasn't there, usually the problem is in the setup. So you go back. And often when you fix the setup, then you can then go forward. It's to put it really simple, it's two steps forward, one step back.
It's kind of like you go down a road, right? And like you kind of get lost mm-hmm. or you hit a dead end. It's like the only way to fix that is to backtrack and get back on the main road and then find the right exit, as it were.
Absolutely. And believe it or not, I don't know why we got to this point, but that's kind of a thematic aspect of this blowback series, and it's my tagline.
That's fantastic.
When the only way forward is back.
That's fantastic. That kind of ties everything together so beautifully. So I love it.
Great.
Well, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Gabriella. It's been really delightful.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for listening, Word Nerds. Keep writing and keep being awesome.